Thanks, Gary. So we come back to Luther then. Just a couple of comments before we move to the actual early part of his life. Various ways have been offered for studying Luther over the years. I think the most ancient one, one might say, is the very brutal way that he was dealt with in the Reformation. The Reformation tended to fall into two camps on Luther. The Roman Catholics presented him very much as a kind of antichrist figure, engaged in Reformation merely because he wanted to marry a nun. We'll come across later in the week. Those of you here later in the week will come across a little bit of that. But on the other side, the Protestants responded with regarding Luther as a savior figure. So when we come to think about Luther's life, there's a temptation, I think, to make him either an unconditionally bad guy or an unconditionally good guy. That's not the way I intend to pursue him today. A second approach, popularized, I think, by the playwright John Osborne, but found in its perhaps its most entertaining form in the book Young Man Luther by Erik Erikson, is the psychological approach that sees Luther as essentially projecting onto God his somewhat dysfunctional relationship with his own father. Erik Erikson, the book, is often very much disparaged by evangelical Christians. I think it's actually not a bad read. I alluded earlier to the fact that I do think that there are psychologically odd things going on with Luther, and it's interesting to reflect upon those. Yes, we know he was a sinful human being like the rest of us are, but in some ways, you know, one of the things that history is always interested in is the particular, not the general. The Twin Towers fell down on 9/11 because of gravity is a true explanation, but an utterly inadequate explanation of the events of 9/11. Why does Luther sin in the particular ways that he does is the interesting question for historians. I think there are all kinds of psychological weirdnesses in Luther, and I'm going to argue that some of that does connect to his dysfunctional relationship with his father. So I'm not an Erik Erikson basher. The approach that I adopt, though, been very influenced by the work of the historian Heiko Obermann and his student David Steinmetz, both of whom now dead. But what Obermann did for Reformation studies in general was, he picked up on the insights of a Jesuit scholar, Joseph Lortz, but what he did was really set the Reformation against the background of late medieval thought. And this has been very influential on my own approach to Luther, that we have to see. You know, the first approach I mentioned, the good guy versus bad guy approach to Luther, tends to see Luther as representing a complete break or rupture with the medieval church and all that went before him. The problem with that approach is nobody represents a complete break or rupture with what's gone before them. We all carry forward certain elements. So when you think that, you know, Luther doesn't come to Reformation notoriety until he's in his mid-30s, which is putting him middle-aged by medieval standards, it beggars belief that he simply breaks with everything that went before. I remember it was a great thing when I turned 40. I felt, now I'm 40, now I turn 50, it's even better. You know, nobody expects you to be open-minded once you've turned 40. I do this tribal challenge race. It's not exactly Ninja Warrior. I watched Australian Ninja Warrior last night. Absolutely fascinating. It's not quite that, but it's a pretty rough race. And a friend and I run it, and we run it with two girls from my church who happen to be there actually in their late 20s. They provide the sort of the fit end of the spectrum, running with these two guys in their late 40s or early 50s. And I remember last year we were being beaten at one point by an all-girl team. And I turned to the girls who were running with me and said, "This is no way am I being beaten by a bunch of girls. We got to take them down." And the girls we were running with sort of said, "Oh, isn't it lovely they're beating us?" And that's a horribly sexist comment you made. And I said, "I know it's a sexist comment, but I'm of a generation where we don't know any better, so you can't hold me accountable for it." So we're all heirs of our upbringing. And Luther is certainly that. And I want to tease some of that out today. And I actually find that very helpful for myself personally as a Christian. It is useful for me to remember that Christianity doesn't end in, say, 451 AD with the Council of Chalcedon and then restart in 1517. Nor can we simply trace our history back by the trail of blood. And we look at the martyrs of the Middle Ages and say, well, that's where the true church was. Many of the martyrs of the Middle Ages would probably have been martyred by Protestants as well, had Protestants been around. I found it very helpful and very liberating myself to realize that actually the reformers built on a lot of what was done in the medieval period. That there is a doctrinal continuity there. I found that very helpful for understanding that there is continuity, and I've also found it very helpful for humility as well, realizing that actually the Protestant church is indebted to the medieval church, that we need to realize that we did not reinvent the wheel in the 16th century, but actually we built upon much of what had gone before. I hope to tease some of that out today. So the approach I want to adopt is Luther's a man of the Middle Ages, and let's see how, you know, if you like, all of the contradictions, all of the problems in the late Middle Ages come to focus on this one man in a peculiar way whose personality is such that he's able to carry things forward. And just to many of you, you can, during the last lecture, I'm going to close the last lecture a little early to throw it open for questions. I won't get to Luther and the Jews today, anywhere near it, but you may want to ask a question about Luther and the Jews, feel free. But one of the things I say about Luther and the Jews is, Luther is a great example of a man whose strength is also his weakness. Most of us, we have fairly mediocre strengths, and the plus of that is we have fairly mediocre weaknesses as well. You cannot have a man who can stand in 1521 at the Diet of Worms before the massed military might and authority of the Holy Roman Empire, pretty much on his own, stand firm. You can't have that man without running the risk of him being disastrous when he gets the wrong end of the stick on something. Luther's personality is, he's arrogant, he's bullheaded, and when he's right, nobody can divert him from his course of action. And that's great when that person is on the right track, and it's a disaster when they're on the wrong track. The problem is, if you've got somebody like Luther who's great when he's on the right track, you always run the risk. You always run the risk of him being on the wrong track and doing something disastrous. You know, I think when you look at it, look at yourself, certainly when I look at myself, I think, yeah, I can see that my strengths are actually also my most fatal and lethal weaknesses. And the things that I've done in life that I think, yeah, I did well there, I can see the same character trait coming through in the things that I look on. I think, well, wow, I wish I hadn't done that. And I think Luther, we need to be somewhat charitable with Luther and say, well, yeah, he did some heroic things, but the problem with a heroic personality is when the heroic personality is on the wrong side of the argument, it can be disastrous. Most of us, it's just great to be more or less mediocre, I think. We do less damage that way, by and large. So who was this man? Well, he was born in 1483 in the town of Eisleben. I think I sent some notes out that are available. He's born in Eisleben, though his parents moved within a very short period of his birth to the town of Mansfeld. He'll actually die in Eisleben in 1546. He doesn't have a whole lot to do with the town in the interim. But he just happens to be there when he's taken with his last illness and dies. You can still visit in the town church there. You can visit the pulpit where he preached his last sermon. And it's a rather unfortunate last sermon because it was fairly typical in the 16th century. Remember, this is an era before newspapers. So by and large, you got your understanding of the world from the pulpit. And it was typical practice in the 16th century at the end of a sermon to add an appendix on an issue of contemporary social or political importance. And Luther's last sermon, some argue it was his last but one sermon, but I think it was his last sermon, has an appendix on the evil of the Jews attached to it. And I remember standing under this pulpit some years ago and I'm praying a prayer to the effect of, I know that I won't do a thousandth of what this man did for the kingdom in my life, but I do hope that my last sermon will be more honoring to God than Luther's last sermon was. And I was kind of amused when I saw online some article about people had to name their favorite sermon. And R.C. Sproul, the American evangelical leader, listed Luther's last sermon as his favorite. And I remember thinking, gosh, I hope he only meant the first part, not the second part. And actually, if you go out of the church there, they have what they call the Judensau over the church door, which is a carving of a pig, a sow, suckling Jewish children, and then a rabbi on the one end with his hand shoved up the pig's backside. And this was a symbol of, you know, Jews not welcome. This was to keep Jews out. And after the Second World War, there was a campaign to have this the Judensau removed. And it was decided to keep it there as a reminder of the horrors of the past. So that's just an aside. Eisleben, where he's born, they moved to Mansfeld in 1484. His father was the eldest son in his family. But German inheritance law meant that the eldest son did not inherit the family farm. I think it was a way of protecting the younger children. So his father became a miner and rose through the ranks of the mining industry to become a superintendent of mines, became part of, you know, if you're a Marxist, you'd say, you know, he became part of the rising bourgeoisie. Luther's father is a man who's made the transition from the working class to the rising middle class. And that's not insignificant. I think that quite often what happens when people enjoy class mobility of that kind, it gives them ambitions for their children. My own father was an orphan, never went to college, or left school at 16. From my earliest days, I knew there was one thing that was going to be true about my life. I was going to go to university because my dad was determined that I would do what he had not had the opportunities to do. He was a classic example of a man who rose from the working class to the middle classes. Luther's father was the same. He has ambitions for his son. His son will become a lawyer. That's his ambition for him. It's cue for all kinds of, you know, lawyer jokes. What are three drowned lawyers at the bottom of the ocean? A good start, you know, that kind of thing. Do you have any lawyers here? Well, shame on you for admitting it in public. That's all I would say. That shows a distinct lack of repentance. Lawyers, you know, typically, I think, if you want to make a lot of money and you have no integrity, there isn't a period in history where law wouldn't be the choice of profession for you. The yellow pages in Philadelphia, I think, would be two-thirds smaller than it is. Philadelphia is the lawyer capital, isn't it, of the USA? Terrible place. But Luther's father, he's a man who worked with his hands, but his ambition, and this is important for the Luther story, his ambition is that Luther himself will not have to labor as he did, but will enjoy the benefits of his father's good fortune and will go on to be part of the intellectual class. And so in 1501, Luther matriculates at the University of Erfurt, where he would have started by doing... It was a fairly medieval university. The Renaissance is sweeping across Europe at this point and is transforming university curricula, but not in Erfurt. Luther went to a very medieval university, and he would have studied a fairly typical medieval curriculum. 1505, he is returning to the university, having been home to visit his mum and his dad, and he's caught in a wild thunderstorm and a bolt of lightning comes crashing down at his side. I make the boast that I've nearly been hit by lightning twice. My wife says that's a lie because in the first place I was indoors and the bolt of lightning landed just off my deck, so I was a good 12 feet away from it. The second time it was about 200 feet away from me. I think my wife will not be satisfied until I'm actually hit by lightning before I actually say this. But the funny thing about being hit by lightning is this will surprise you. It is an absolutely terrifying experience because by the time you realize what's happened, it's all over. You just see this like what I saw was like a blue glowing pillar for a split second, and then it's gone. But I'm a man of the modern age. When I see a lightning bolt, I think, well, you know, there are all these huge ice crystals crashing around in the upper atmosphere, creating a massive ionic imbalance that then earths itself 12 feet away from me, 20 feet away from me, half a mile away, whatever. The bolt of lightning comes to ground, earths itself. But this is where one of the very first points I made about Luther becomes significant. That's my world. I live in the world that has been, you know, explained scientifically. That's not Luther's world. For Luther, natural phenomena are supernatural phenomena. I love in class sometimes throwing out the virtual history question, you know, those hypotheticals. You know, ask her, what would have happened if Luther's first child had been stillborn? Well, it would have been a tragedy for the family, but just think about that. Because what is a stillborn child? A stillborn child to us is a tragedy, isn't it? It's a tragedy that sadly affects some families. Often we don't know why, but we assume there's a medical reason for it. Even if there's no obvious explanation, we assume something just went horribly wrong somewhere. If Luther's first child had been stillborn, that would have been seen as the judgment of God. What if he'd been born without an arm or without a leg? The Reformation, I think, would have suffered a massive setback. Massive setback if Luther's first child had been stillborn. Because it's a very different world. When Luther's nearly hit by lightning, for him, this is the finger of God. This is a direct act of God. And he throws himself to the ground and he cries out as he falls, "St. Anne, help me, and I will become a monk." And for many years, I wondered, why did he call out St. Anne? Then I looked it up on Wikipedia, and I found out the answer. St. Anne's actually an incredibly helpful saint for Luther in this particular situation. First of all, she's the patron saint of those caught in thunderstorms. So she's the ideal saint to call out to. But she's also the patron saint of miners. Luther comes from a mining family. So she's this incredible two-for-one saint on this particular cry. And I think what Luther, it's kind of touching in some ways. I think what Luther does here is you see the piety of the family coming out of this. But I can imagine Luther's mother would have led the little children in the family in prayer for Dad when he's down the mine. And they'd have prayed to St. Anne to look after Dad when he was down the mine, when he was conducting this terribly dangerous activity. Scholars debate whether Luther had, you know, in some ways the story sounds too trite. Did he already have plans to enter the monastery? And did he just use the thunderstorm as a sort of excuse that his parents couldn't respond to? Maybe, we will never know. But certainly the thunderstorm provides the context. And Luther goes off and presents himself just a few days later to the Augustinian cloister in Erfurt. Some people think, well, the choice of Augustinians, that's significant. Because, you know, Augustine is going to be a huge influence on the Reformation. Luther will join the University of Wittenberg, where there's this group of academics studying the thinking of St. Augustine. And it's Augustine that really catalyzes Luther's own thinking. In fact, it's just really the name of the order. It doesn't necessarily indicate that the order was particularly adept at the theology of Augustine. It was just it was just the name they had. It was also a relatively unimportant order. Luther's father is furious that he chooses to go into the Augustinians. He's furious that he's giving up this career at law. but he's also furious that he's chosen one of the least prestigious, one of the less prestigious monastic orders. If you were around at the beginning of the 16th century and you wanted to join a prestigious order, you'd probably join the Dominicans or the Franciscans. Really, late medieval intellectual life is dominated by theologians of those two orders. The Dominicans are the order of preachers, the Franciscans, the lesser brethren. Both have 13th century origins, and by the time we get to the 16th century, they are the intellectual powerhouses of the Catholic Church. They will be very easily supplanted by the Jesuits within half a century. But they are the prestigious place to go. I say to students, typically, when you think about the Luther's choice, it's a little bit like he decides to go to the local community college, having got a place at a prestigious university. That's how it infuriates his father. Not only is he frustrating his father's plans, he's not bringing any prestige to the family by joining the Augustinian order. So he joins the Augustinians in 1505. And then in 1507, he makes a very, very important decision. He's ordained as a priest. And this is critical, because what this means is that Luther will not only engage in the typical monastic activities of contemplation, he will also have pastoral responsibilities. That Luther is a priest is very, very important to the Luther story, because it's really his pastoral sensitivities that catapult him into the Reformation. It's an important moment in Luther's life as he's celebrating his first Mass as priest. He has some kind of nervous breakdown. And this is, you know, Erikson is very interested in this. His father is present. His father is present for his first Mass, even though he disapproves of Luther's vocation. His father is present there. And that must have put huge psychological pressure on Luther. And certainly, as I've said, I am not one who dismisses the impact of Luther's father on the way he frames his spiritual life. My dad always wanted me to be a doctor. And I became a doctor, but not quite the kind of doctor my dad wanted. Dad wanted a doctor that brought some prestige and money. But I've often wondered, when I became a Christian, did I become the kind of Christian that I thought my father would approve of? One that used his brain. My dad had never been to college. I said he'd got this thing about education, about reading, about being intellectual. Maybe my father had a huge impact unconsciously on decisions I made relative to my own, the shape of my own Christian life. Certainly don't want to discount that at all. And without wanting to project myself back into Luther, I see no reason to think that Luther too wasn't profoundly influenced by his father. Particularly, I got on very well with my father, particularly thinking of the hostility that existed at this point between Luther and his father. Luther has a breakdown. But I think there's also something else going on at this first Mass that we need to be aware of, because it shapes Luther as a Protestant. And that is the whole doctrine of transubstantiation. You're probably familiar with the word. Transubstantiation. Transubstantiation as a doctrine really emerges in the 13th century. Fourth Lateran Council of 1215 refers to it. It's central to Roman Catholic piety. If you go into a beautiful medieval cathedral, I had the pleasure recently of going to spending a week in Italy with my wife. When I was banned from taking any academic books, we just spent a whole week wandering around Italy. It was wonderful. But you go into any decently constructed Italian church or cathedral, and your eyes are immediately drawn to the altar. The architect knows his theology, and he's constructed a church building to reflect the priorities of Roman Catholic piety. And you're taken to the altar. Why? Because that is where God meets his people in Roman Catholic theology. What happens when the priest pronounces the words of consecration at Mass is the bread and the wine become Christ. But it's not that the bread becomes the sort of somehow anemic flesh and the wine becomes the blood. The whole Christ is there both in the bread and in the wine. And Catholic theology adopts a distinction from Aristotle that it uses in a very un-Aristotelian way. Distinction between substance and accidents. Substance is that which makes a thing what it is. I've got a glass of water here. It has the substance of water. That's what makes it what it is. It has certain accidents, those properties that I perceive. It's liquid. I can sip it. It has a certain lack of taste, one might say. It has certain empirical qualities that I can perceive that allow me to know that it's water. They're the accidents, the accidental properties. Well, Roman Catholic theology says that when the words of consecration are pronounced, the accidents of bread and wine remain. It looks like bread, it looks like wine, it tastes like bread, it tastes like wine. But the substance of bread and wine changes into Christ. Now, we as Protestants might look on that and think, we don't believe that. But imagine, remember what I said about being a historian? You have to be able to think yourself back into somebody else's shoes and to think sympathetically as they do, even if you disagree with them. Let's suspend our 21st century Protestant thinking for a moment and go back to 1507. And you are Martin Luther and you are pronouncing those words of consecration. And the bread and the wine are turning into the body and blood of the Lord Jesus Christ. Is that not a terrifying thing to do? Would you not be terrified? Particularly if, like Luther, you have a sensitive conscience and you're aware of how inadequate you are before a holy God. Would you not be concerned about making God and touching God? I think you would. And I think what we see in 1507 is Luther's, a couple of things I think emerging. One, Luther's sense of his own unworthiness and his exalted sense of the sacrament, both of which will stay with him forever. And Luther has a breakdown, I think, in part because this is an overwhelming thing for him to do. We poo-poo it because we don't think the way Luther thought. But for Luther, he's doing something that is overwhelming at this point. And it does not surprise me that it causes serious Anfechtungen, one might say, in his life. So the first Mass is very, very important for understanding Luther. And one of the things that students often say is, well, how come he has this thing about the Lord's Supper? Why is the Lord's Supper so important to him throughout his life? And part of me wants to go back to 1507 and say, well, look at 1507. It's had a huge impact on him as a young man. We might say it scarred him or it marked him for life, such that, in later life, he will always have more time for Roman Catholicism and transubstantiation than he will have for Zwingli and his memorialist view of the Lord's Supper. If he has to choose which era he's going to go with, he'll go with transubstantiation, not with the symbolism of Zurich. 1508, he is moved by his order to become lecturer at the new University of Wittenberg in Electoral Saxony. The most important move he makes in his entire life. He will return to Erfurt briefly a year or two later and then return to Wittenberg forever. He will remain a professor at the University of Wittenberg. Founded in 1501, it's a new university. That it's a new university, again, is not incidental to the Luther story. Because what do new universities want? They want to compete. They want to establish their name. They want prestige. It will not harm the university, and it will therefore not harm Luther, that he becomes a very controversial figure. By 1525, this will be one of the most popular universities in Europe because of the presence of this one man, essentially, Martin Luther. So Luther being in a new university will be a tremendous advantage to him. It's also in the territory of Electoral Saxony. The name is important, Electoral Saxony. Saxony is part of the Holy Roman Empire. Medieval Europe is dominated, mainland Europe is dominated by two powers. You have the papacy and you have the Holy Roman Empire. I think it was Voltaire who said the Holy Roman Empire was not holy, it was not Roman, and it was not an empire. Founded by Charlemagne, 9th century. It's interesting, if you look at the coins that Charlemagne had struck, it presents him as a Roman emperor with the laurel wreath. It's very self-conscious drawing on the old Roman Empire. The Holy Roman Empire was a rather chaotic collection of states in Central Europe, ruled, surprise, surprise, as most empires are, by an emperor. The House of Habsburg, the Spanish royal family, is at this point in time the ruler of the rulers of the Holy Roman Empire. But unlike some empires, the crown of the emperor does not pass along familial lines. Just because your father is the emperor does not mean that you will become the emperor. In actual fact, on the basis of the Golden Bull of 13 something or other, I can't remember the date, the Holy Roman Emperor is elected by an electoral college. 7 of the territories in the empire are governed by a prince who is an elector, who has a vote. It's an electoral college of 7 men. An electoral Saxony is one of those territories. This is of incalculable importance in the Luther story, because it means that although he's a professor at a tiny university in the backwater town of Wittenberg, in a territory of the empire that is not particularly economically or militarily significant, it is procedurally hugely significant. First of all, it will mean when there is no emperor, Frederick the Wise, the Elector of Saxony, has huge influence in imperial policy. And secondly, it will mean that when there is an emperor, the emperor has always got a balance in his mind the advantages of civil war over the advantages of a policy of containment. And Luther will survive, where others, other reformers in the Middle Ages, John Wycliffe survived because he was English, he was on an island. John Huss was not so lucky. Luther will survive because he's a part of the empire. And the emperor will always make the decision that it is better not to invade Electoral Saxony and plunge the empire into civil war than to do so. If he can contain Luther, that's what he wants to do. It's interesting to me that the Lutherans form what they call the Schmalkaldic League in 1530-1531, which is an alliance of Lutheran princes and territories committed to military protection of the Lutheran Church. The emperor will not declare war on the League until 1547. It's only when Luther dies that the emperor thinks that he stands a chance of winning. The hold that Luther had over the imagination, even of the emperor, he colonized the emperor's brain. The emperor will not declare war on the Lutherans until Luther himself is dead. And if you ever go, have you ever had the pleasure of going to Wittenberg, going to the church and go to Luther's grave. He was a tiny guy. I guess he was 5'2", 5'3". His grave is very tiny. But there was this moment when in 1547 the imperial army rolls into Wittenberg and the emperor and his Spanish aide-de-camp march into the church, and the emperor, who's only met Luther once, and that was at the Diet of Worms, stands at the grave of this man whose life completely defined Charles V's rule. Completely ruined his rule in many ways. And the Spanish aide-de-camp draws out his sword and he cuts the portrait of Luther that hangs over his grave. And he turns to the emperor and says, let's dig him up and burn him at the stake, which was the sort of the standard thing to do with heretics. If you couldn't get them when they're alive, you burn them when they're dead. And the emperor looks at him and says, I make no war on dead men, and walks out of the chapel. And you just feel there's a kind of exhaustion. He hasn't even got the energy to dig the guy up and burn him. Luther utterly ruined the rule of Charles V. And so Luther is, his position, his positioning in electoral Saxony is critical, because it actually, the way history plays out will put him in a peculiarly powerful political position that nobody could have predicted. I think if Luther had been elsewhere in the empire, it would have gone very, very differently. As a monk, he starts to struggle more than ever with a sense of his own sinfulness. He starts to really wrestle with the fact that he cannot stand righteous before God. And this is, well, it's exacerbated by the theology that he's taught by his medieval masters. This is where it gets a little bit technical, but is quite important for an understanding of Luther. Luther schooled in what, it's only a term that later scholars have coined. Luther's, is there a brush?
The black thing.
Oh, here. Yeah. Oh, wow. It's, that's great. And it sticks to the board. That's really very helpful. If any of you have magnetic heads, I can throw it at you and it will do serious damage. So, Luther schooled in a theology which later scholars call the Via Moderna. Late medieval scholars make a distinction between the Via Moderna and its alternative, the Via Antiqua, the modern way and the ancient way. Lots gone on in late medieval Europe. One of the things I think that most scholars now are pretty agreed upon is that a certain, to use a slightly sort of pompous way of putting it, a certain epistemological pessimism has set into Europe. When I teach medieval thought, I often move, make this point, I move from Anselm through Aquinas to somebody called Duns Scotus to William of Ockham. I look at the way a particular question is looked at. The question I throw out is, you know, was it necessary? If for God to forgive sin, was it necessary that Christ become man? And the answer that Anselm gives, of course, is yes. God's honor needs to be satisfied, and it needs to be satisfied infinitely, so only God can do it. But because it has to be also satisfied by somebody who's obliged to do it, therefore Christ has to become, you know, you have to have a God-man, you have to have Christ. And it's very clear when you read Anselm that he's very much working against the background of medieval feudalism. The idea that God is like a feudal lord, and when his honor is damaged, his honor needs to be repaired in some way. You move forward a century or two to Aquinas, and you look at how he asks the same question, and Aquinas' answer is no, it is not necessary for Christ, to be a God-man, for God to forgive sin, but there are certain advantages there too, which, you know, make it, you know, advantageous for God to do this. So in theory, God could have acted just to forgive sin by an act of his will, but in actual fact, because there are certain helpful aspects of the incarnation was still pretty likely. Then we move to Duns Scotus and William of Ockham. By the way, Aquinas is a Dominican. These two guys are Franciscans. Scotus and Ockham, Duns Scotus, interesting. We get the English word dunce from Duns. He's a Scotsman. Duns Scotus stuff is so complex and arcane, you know, he's either a genius or an idiot. And the dunce comes from Duns Scotus. There is a story which is sadly apocryphal. I used to tell this as true, but it's sadly apocryphal. And not for Duns Scotus, it's, you know, for him, it's a good job it's apocryphal. But the story was that he's buried in the crypt of Cologne Cathedral, which he is. And the story was that when they opened the crypt to bury the next guy after Duns Scotus, they found his body outside of his coffin. So they obviously buried him alive. And he died in the cold and dark. Sorry, I shouldn't smile when I'm telling this. Died in the cold and dark of the crypt in Cologne Cathedral. Sadly, I'm told that's apocryphal. It's one of the greatest church stories ever. And it's apocryphal. Duns Scotus and Ockham, their answer to the question is the only rationale for the incarnation is the will of God. The only rationale is that God decided to do it that way. We cannot speculate behind or beyond that. It's an interesting move, because one way you could say about that, the sort of story of Anselm to Ockham, is this. It's an increasing lack of confidence in the human mind to predict how God should act. And there are various material reasons, I think, that kick into this. 14th century, the Great Plague. You know, the Great Plague wiped out millions of people. I was thinking, when the plague comes to Zurich in 1519, 25% of the population of Zurich dies, 1519 to 1520, from the Great Plague. Can you imagine in your churches, sort of church yesterday, maybe there were 150 people there, but knowing that in 6 months' time, a quarter of those people would have died from the mumps or something. It's hard for us to put our heads around, but I guarantee one thing, it would give you a view of the world that was rather unpredictable and pessimistic, if that's happening. So there are reasons, I think, socially and culturally in the Middle Ages why people are getting more pessimistic. The world is becoming a scarier place. The world is a scary, unpredictable place. And you see this slow loss of confidence in the human mind to predict how God will act. And this manifests itself in two particular philosophical streams. I don't want to go into all the details here. Coming from Duns and even more from Ockham. Voluntarism and nominalism. Voluntarism emphasizes the will of God. Why do things happen? God will. We all say that, but we can often think God wills things because they're good. The voluntarist would say, no, things are good because God wills them. From a human perspective, we cannot use our human criteria of what is good and apply that to God and then try to explain what he's doing on the basis of that. We have to look, first of all, at what God has willed, and then we understand how God acts. We can't predict how God acts in advance. That's very important for the Reformation, because what that does, of course, is it pushes you to revelation. These theologians, Scotus and Ockham, place much more of an emphasis upon divine revelation as a way of thinking about how God exists. Now, for them, revelation is the teaching of the church. But it's a small step from that to revelation as scripture, which is the step that Luther will make. Secondly, nominalism. Nominalism. There's a great battle that goes on, really, from ancient philosophy onwards and then through the Middle Ages, as to the way words function. You have a dog. Do you call your dog a dog because it participates in some kind of universal dogginess that's out there in the ideal sphere? Or do you call your dog a dog like you call your neighbor's dog a dog, simply because they seem to have more things in common than they have with, say, a stone or a human being? We might say that what nominalists do is see language as constituting the reality of the world. It's a rather simplistic way of putting it. But this too will be very important for Luther, because when you think about it, when you think about Luther, what is justification for Luther? Luther, justification is God saying that you are righteous. It is not that you are intrinsically righteous, it is that God gives the word. That person is righteous. Reality, we might say, follows on the word, does not precede the word. Some very interesting connections, I think, between this and postmodernism. But these two schools, Luther is trained in. And it comes, for him, it sort of comes to focus in on the issue of how to know that he's right before God. Luther's Via Moderna, voluntarist, nominalist teachers teach him that, well, God has set up, we know, according to God's revelation, according to them, God has set up this pact, this pactum. where the one who does their best, literally the Latin is the one who does what is in them, but we can translate that as to the one who does their best, God does not deny grace. God can do that because he's all powerful. We just look at his will. We don't predetermine what God's will can do. If God wishes to save people in this way, then he can do that. And he will set up a system where if you do your best, he will not deny you grace. Just as an aside, think about what these theologians are doing there. They're rooting your status before God in a decision of God, not in an intrinsic quality in yourself. Gary and myself have known each other for 29 years now. Gosh, yeah, doesn't time fly. 29 years. Gary is a godlier man than I am. For Gary doing his best, therefore, the bar is going to be set so much higher than for me. Gary comes to me and says, I'm worried that I'm not right with God. And I say to him, well, have you done your best? And Gary says to me, well, I got up at 6 o'clock this morning and I helped 25 old ladies cross the road. And I say, well, that's fantastic. I've never managed more than six. And Gary says, yeah, but typically I'm achieving 30, 35. And I said, well, you haven't done your best then, Gary. God may yet deny you grace. But me being a somewhat more reprobate sort of figure, for me to achieve 6 to 10, that's amazing. So I do that and God gives me grace. The brilliance of this system is that it's personally tailored to the individual. So Luther goes to his confessor and he confesses his sins. And it should be sufficient to assure his conscience that God will be gracious to him. But it doesn't do that. And it doesn't do that because there is a fatal pastoral flaw in this approach. And the fatal pastoral flaw is, how do you know when you've done your best? The system that is designed to try to help Luther's conscience becomes a terrible, terrible burden upon his conscience. It presses him continually because he's never sure that he's done his best. And Luther really plunges into despair in the second decade of the 16th century, a despair that is exacerbated by the system of theology he's been taught, and which provides the background to his Reformation breakthrough on justification. On the one hand, he will carry some of the things over into the Reformation, the idea that justification is a declaration of God, not based upon the intrinsic character of the individual. He'll carry over. On the other hand, he has to come to understand, how can this pactum be fulfilled? How can I reach this condition in the pactum? Now, I think, Gary, 11:45 was the time for the next break. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. We've hit the witching hour in that case. We'll reconvene at 12, and that's the last lecture before lunch. So if you want to know how Luther solves the pactum, you're going to have to come back, I'm afraid, in 15 minutes' time. I'm trying to set my lectures up as a sort of soap opera here. So 15 minutes, come on back, and we will address how Luther overcomes this.